This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace. Personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur is a discussion of the natural consequences of actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymphd. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur originated as the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio. The weather and climate news felt too urgent to abandon when Extinction Radio went on hiatus last spring, so Sequitur became a freestanding podcast. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded beyond extreme weather events and natural disasters to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book The Myth of Human Supremacy to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. Aho, Mitakwe Owasan, we are all related. It's that solstice time of the year, and I'm reminded of the power of the sun in shaping our experience of life on this planet. Those of us in the Northern Hemisphere are celebrating the return of the sun and the emergence from the darkness as the days grow longer, and our friends down under are celebrating the impending harvest season and relief from the record-breaking heat as the days grow shorter. As mentioned last month on the Gratitude Show, Sequitur is reclaiming the original meaning of the winter holidays that makes them holy days. For the solstice holiday, we celebrate generosity. Christians celebrate their God's gift to the world of His only begotten Son. Many non-Christians celebrate the generosity of the Son Himself in providing light, warmth, and food. The 14th century Sufi poet Hafiz wrote, "Even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, 'You owe me.' Look what happens with a love like that. It lights the whole sky." I invited my colleague John Cossum to set the theme for our seasonal celebration by saying a few words about what we mean by generosity, and I sent him that quote from Hafiz to stimulate his thinking. And since this is the third consecutive Sequitur to which he is contributing, I feel called to introduce John more thoroughly to you, our faithful listeners. I first met John as John Compost Cossum, the proponent of low-carbon living, as you heard on his first segment last month. What only a few in his global community know about John is his professional identity as Professor Fiddlesticks, a children's entertainer, mostly within a 20-mile radius of his local community of York, UK. His Facebook page is Professor Fiddlesticks, and he is on the web at www.professor-fiddlesticks.co.uk. Be sure to watch the YouTube video embedded on his homepage.
Thank you, Susan, for inviting me to talk on Sequitur again. This is John Cossum speaking from York in the UK. And today's subject is generosity. So this may be seen initially as to do with money, giving it to other people, which of course is possible if you have spare money or if you're rich enough to afford it. But in my mind, generosity is much, much more than that. I've got a nice quote from Steve Goodyear from Goodreads. "Money is not the only commodity that is fun to give. We can give time, we can give our expertise, we can give our love, or simply give a smile. What does that cost? The point is, none of us can ever run out of something worthwhile to give." So, giving is obviously much more than just donating money to a charity or to a homeless person. We might understand that people who give freely could be seen as having a well-developed personality because they're not anchored in attachments, having to have stuff. They don't mind sharing it or giving it. Or imagine stories about scarcity. We live in a world of abundance, certainly when it comes to what humans can give to each other. The Dalai Lama said, "Generosity is the most natural outward expression of an inner attitude of compassion and loving kindness." And in fact, when reading up about what generosity was, I did find a lot of mentions of compassion and humility. So it is a very worthwhile thing to cultivate in yourself. I think that generosity extends a lot further than just giving of your time or giving of your expertise, your knowledge, or giving of gifts. I think that generosity could also include who you're prepared to be friends with or spend time with, who you open your heart to. I'm thinking a bit more than social media as well, although it certainly includes that. I think that by being willing to be exposed to views which don't chime with your own is an act of generosity to other people, and it certainly helps you grow as a person, and it challenges your patience and empathy. I recommend practicing generosity. It is a good feeling to share and give, and it certainly makes for a better world, at least I think so. Sharing resources makes ecological sense too. For instance, loaning someone a tool or a book means they don't have to buy their own, and that saves energy and saves resources. If you want to focus on this aspect of generosity, you could go to a website called StreetBank, which enables people to share things with their neighbours, including skills, not just tools. If you want to give things away for free, then you could look at FreeCycle and Freegal. You might want to have a think about the recipients of your generosity. They're not passive. They may very well be inspired to give themselves. There are a couple of good quotes about the recipients of generosity. So Jay Perry says, "Asking for and receiving help is a way to prime the pump of generosity." And this is echoed by Jean-Paul Sartre. "The poor don't know that their function in life is to exercise our generosity." So I haven't really sat down and thought about generosity very much. People say that I am generous in spirit, but I don't really know what they mean because I'm not trying to be generous, or I don't set out to be anything other than I am. I certainly like my stuff, and I don't give everything away. I make things and I sell them. I try and ask for a fee for the children's entertainment performances that I do. But I have an approach to my fees which I suppose could be generous, because I don't set a fee which is fixed. I say to people, "Well, I've been paid between this amount, and my average fee is this, so what were you thinking of paying me? What can you afford?" Now that is a kind of generosity, because what I'm doing is allowing people to access my services for almost whatever price they can afford to give me. It doesn't always work out in my favour. Some people might take advantage of me, but also when I've explained about my average fee, very occasionally, somebody is generous to me and says, "Well, if that's your average, I'll give you a little bit more." It also means that when I'm approached by a business for my entertainment, then sometimes they won't understand my flexibility of fees, and I'll say, "What's your budget then?" And they'll say some astronomical price, and I'll say, "That sounds lovely, I'll take that." So it works in my favour that I don't have a set fee. But I think that being generous to get something in return is a weird form of generosity. But we may be conscious that we're doing that. I certainly feel that in my relationships, I'm a giver. I like to entertain. I like to spend time with people. I like to help. this isn't purely a selfless act, because I actually get quite a buzz from entertaining people and helping people and hearing people's problems and issues. I enjoy that. So although it might seem like a generous act in itself, I am gaining something from that. So what can I say? Just try and be generous. If you don't feel you're very generous, try and be a bit more generous. Share, give freely. Realise that we can't take our stuff with us when we go. So share it around. I think we can all agree that generosity is a very positive attribute, and we should all endeavour to be more generous to each other.
Thank you, John Cossum, for your scholarship illuminated by personal example. Your words speak to decolonizing generosity from the capitalist ideal of exchanging gifts that is so prevalent in our consumer culture. And you hinted at a theme elaborated by the late Marshall Rosenberg, founder of nonviolent communication, the language of the heart. At his trainings, Dr. Rosenberg used to like to sing Given To, a song by Ruth Babermeyer that explores this blurring of the distinction between giving and receiving that results in that buzz you mentioned that happens when we exercise our generosity. To this end, NVC trainer Dorset Campbell Ross likes to quote Dr. Rosenberg's Hungry Duck criterion. Quote, "Look at a child feeding hungry ducks. Who's having the most fun, the child or the ducks? Never do anything in life unless it's with the joy of a child feeding hungry ducks," unquote. Because when we do something because we think we have to, or must, or have no choice, we will do it with resentment that will build over time and lead to the breakdown of communication and relationships, and can even make us emotionally and physically ill. I downloaded Dorset Campbell Ross performing Given To at a training he gave in Bali in 2014, and I'm going to play it for you now.
I never feel more given to than when you take from me, when you understand the joy I feel caring for you. And you know my giving isn't done to put you in my debt, but because I want to live the love I feel for you. To receive with grace may be the greatest giving. There's no way I can separate the two. When you give to me, I give you my receiving. And when you take from me, I feel so given to.
When you give to me, I give you my receiving. When you take from me, I feel so given to. That was Given To by Ruth Babermeyer, performed by Dorset Campbell Ross. It is meant to be a children's song. Dr. Rosenberg's Hungry Duck criterion is a metaphor about children, and John Cossum is a children's entertainer. Yet John and I acknowledged to each other that we had each independently recognized mature sexual relations as a sterling example of that blurring of the distinction between giving and receiving. Besides our personal pleasure, we take pleasure in our partner's pleasure. Another example through the eyes of a child. If you've ever been in the company of a pre-verbal child with something good to eat, even something imaginary or symbolic, I'm sure you've been offered a share of the treat. And what delight the child takes as you pretend to eat and exclaim over the pretended sensory satisfaction, yum, yum. So if generosity is our natural state, how have we strayed so far from the joy of giving and receiving? Remember the line from Starhawk's Invocation to the Four Sacred Things I read when Sequitur launched back in May. To honor the sacred is to make love possible. In our money-based secular world, we have forgotten to honor the sacred. In our quest for scientific objectivity, we have thrown the baby, our love child, out with the bathwater of domination by religious elites. So our holidays are no longer holy days. Charles Eisenstein teaches that it is time for our species to evolve our love for the mother from adolescent testing and discovery behaviors to the reciprocal love relationship of mature adults. His work is archived at charleseisenstein.net on a gift economy basis or through Amazon in the more conventional way. His last name is spelled E-I-S-E-N-S-T-E-I-N. His most recent book, The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, is also his most accessible. Its short, self-contained chapters read like bedtime stories. If your taste runs to the more scholarly, try The Ascent of Humanity that traces our cultural predicament from an evolutionary as well as a historical perspective, or the epic Sacred Economics, perhaps his best-known work, that earned him the title of Guru of Gift Economy, which title he disowns so vehemently that he really doesn't write about economics much anymore. The September edition of Cosmos Online featured an article by Llewellyn Vaughn Lee titled The Loss of the Sacred and a Prayer for the Earth that brings us right back to the language of the heart and the generosity of our planet toward all our relations. I'm going to quote from it extensively by way of bridging the gap between our discussion of generosity and a check-in with Standing Rock and other indigenous movements worldwide that are praying together for a reawakening of reverence for the sacred. The song immediately following the quote is aptly titled, The Whole World is Watching. The world is dying. Dying both from our industrial exploitation, the toxins of our culture, the loss of species, and also dying from the loss of the sacred. And while we can see the signs of our environmental plundering, the inner ravages of the soul and the world soul, the anima mundi, go unnoticed. We have forgotten how to read the signs. We have forgotten the language of the soul. So I am left with the question that keeps haunting me. What will it take for us to awaken? And more important, what will it take for the world to awaken, for the song of creation to be heard once again? In that song, all of life becomes alive in a new way, and joy and meaning can return to the ravaged landscapes of the soul. If we can hear the cry of the earth, feel this grief in our soul, then something in our heart opens. We are not separate from the earth. Her loss is our loss, her cry our cry. Our heart becomes the earth's prayer that calls, and love the response to that call. We are drawn back to the simple human values of love and care for the earth and its myriad inhabitants. Only our love for the earth can heal what we have devastated, redeem the inner and outer wasteland we have made through our greed and forgetfulness. It may seem too simple and idealistic, an inadequate response to the realities of ecological devastation, but love and prayer can reawaken the sacred within creation, make the ground under our feet both whole and holy. We need to remember and return to what is sacred, to the hidden music of creation, the heartbeat of the world. Only then will our actions be in harmony with all of life.
Rock, we've gotta make a stand. Time is slipping, slipping through our hands. Say a prayer for the promised land. They poison our water, you know it's a sin. The spirit's talking, they're not listening. They're taking from the earth and never giving. They won't stop till there's nothing left living. The whole world's watching. rock. Drum beats sounding at the break of dawn. Give us the strength to carry on. Light of the sky world will see us through. For our sons and daughters and the nation of the Sioux. Whole world's watching. Watching over Standing Rock. Hear the voices calling to draw a line.
That was The Whole World is Watching by Pray with Standing Rock. You can download it at bandcamp.com on a gift economy basis. Next, I've got a distillation of a fine piece of writing by Jiwa Woodbury for Counterpunch from earlier this week, titled, in an obvious reference to the Northern Hemisphere's solstice observations, Standing Rock's Prayerful Resistance, A Ray of Light in the Darkest Night. Here's his introduction to the topic. Quote, as a lifelong eco-activist in an age of accelerating climate mayhem and cultural comatosity in the face of that existential threat, I've had to learn to embrace the darkness. Winter solstice, the longest, coldest night, symbolic of darkness itself, has become my high holy day, a celebration of the pagan belief that no matter how cold and dark things get, the warming light will return. As this winter solstice approaches, I can honestly say that the forces of darkness have never seemed as powerfully ascendant in my life as they do right now. End quote. There follows a politically flavored rant regarding the recent POTUS election and proposed cabinet appointments before his transition to Standing Rock. Quote, something peculiar happened on our way to the killing fields of Armageddon. Suddenly, seemingly out of nowhere, the First Nations drew a line in the tar sands, declared the earth sacred, and vowed to kill the black snake right there at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. Hundreds of other indigenous tribes from around the world heard the call, and miracle of miracles, people began listening. As someone who has been on the front lines of the eco-defense movement here in the Northern Rockies for the last two decades, and as someone who has grown increasingly exasperated with the head-against-the-wall tactics of the climate movement, I am here to tell you something has seriously shifted. And if we know what is good for our mother, we will never be the same movement again. So what has really changed? What shifted at Standing Rock? Answering these questions correctly is crucial. If we do not learn the historic lessons of Standing Rock, then we as a movement will be overwhelmed by the forces of darkness that are quickly spreading and fracturing the land, poisoning the waters, snuffing out sea life, and blotting out the sun with acrid smoke from the battlefields, burning rainforests, and coal-fired power plants that cover the planet. The first seismic lesson from our elders at Standing Rock: we are protectors, not protesters. Words have power. How long have my bravely suffering brothers and sisters been tortured in the woods and marginalized by corporate media under the label protester? In this day and age, it is not enough to be against something if that dissent overshadows and obscures what it is you stand for. Whenever we are asked why we oppose something, we must answer the way a politician answers a question, by turning the conversation to what we stand for, not playing along with the polarizing story of opposition. And what is the unifying vision that includes the idea of water protectors? It is the re-emergent worldview that the Earth is a natural life source, not a natural resource. The age of commodification is at an end. Or, in the words of Lakota elder and 19th generation keeper of the sacred white buffalo calf pipe bundle, Chief Arville Looking Horse, quote, "We recognize our umbilical connection to Mother Earth and understand that she is the source of life, not a resource to be exploited. We respect and honor our spiritual relationship with the lifeblood of Mother Earth. One does not sell or contaminate their mother's blood." End embedded quote. Defend the sacred is the call that went out from Standing Rock. That is why identifying ourselves as protectors in this time of unparalleled peril resonates so powerfully with so many people around the world, because that is the kind of fierce activism that is called for by our collective circumstance. Protesters, by contrast, have been marginalized by corporate media and corporate politicians as just another special interest. But speaking for the common interest has not exactly won the day against the forces of avarice and greed, has it? Something has been missing all along in the environmental movement from Earth Day forward, something that has prevented us from winning the hearts and minds of average Americans living normal lives in the corporate matrix: the power of prayer. But you can't become a protector of something that is sacred in a way that actually connects with all who hear and see your efforts unless you are willing to express that deep connection in an authentic way. Otherwise, you will continue to be relegated to permitted protests on the margins of society. Prayer is powerful. Can you imagine the civil rights movement succeeding without the strength that came from Black people praying together? Does anyone who closely followed Standing Rock believe it would have succeeded without prayer, or without keeping the children who started it all close to heart while continuing to listen to the elders? Can we even relate anymore to a culture that is motivated to act for their children's future and listen to their elders? But the prayerful power emanating from Standing Rock isn't about religion. Instead, it's about expressing a spiritual worldview that recognizes the inner and interconnectivity of people and the planet, human nature and the natural world. It's about having the conversation Pope Francis called for in his encyclical about what it means to be human. This spiritual worldview may be common to all religions, but it belongs to none. It predates religion, in fact, and is still embodied in the first peoples of the world, as well as in our own pagan roots as reflected in the rituals of the solstice season. This radically subversive, ensouled worldview has been culturally drummed out of us because it is anathema to the consumerism that fuels corporate domination of the world as resource, not life source. I can speak from experience in telling you that cynicism about this natural human urge to connect spiritually with one another through nature is no substitute for activism, and we are all being called by Earth to become climate activists now. But how we choose to engage is more important than if we choose to engage. As climate author Charles Eisenstein points out in his recent essay titled Standing Rock, A Change of Heart, quote, "If this planet and our civilization are to heal, it cannot be through winning a contest of force. By entering into war mentality, we strengthen the field of war, including the reduction and domination of nature." End embedded quote. Another political observer who appreciates the historic significance of what just happened at Standing Rock, Richard Moser, sums up the reasoning underlying this social imperative to be prayerful in our activism quite nicely. Quote, "In a world hungry for spiritual sustenance, the fusion of politics and the sacred has already touched millions. Like most white people, I know little of native beliefs. But the straightforward reverence for nature, a theme common to many indigenous cultures, is a universal truth that appeals to the whole person and to people around the whole world." End embedded quote. Even the veterans showed up unarmed at Standing Rock, including indigenous member of Congress Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, which forced President Obama's hand politically. And each of the 25,000 men, women, and children that were standing as one, united by prayer when the Army Corps of Engineers backed down at Standing Rock, would agree that what happened there on the frigid, blizzard-swept banks of the Missouri River was just the beginning of something much larger than stopping a pipeline in its tracks. That is their prayer, still carrying on the wind and on the water across Turtle Island and around the earth, falling on our privileged ears. End quote. You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart, archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. But make no mistake, gentle listeners, the Army Corps of Engineers did not back down because of a crisis of conscience or a change of heart. The physical fact of the matter is that you can't drill in the frozen earth, and the mother sent an early blizzard only hours after the veterans arrived, followed by temperatures last weekend in the minus teens Fahrenheit, that's about minus 25 C, with wind chills in the minus 50s, F or C, according to a YouTube interview dated 17 December, with the Extreme Energy and Just Transition Coordinator, whose name was unfortunately cut off at the beginning of the video, but is perhaps Candy Moffitt? And the Army Corps of Engineers did not deny the permit, they only refused to issue it until after an environmental impact study can be conducted, and they are requiring only a study of the section to be rerouted, not of the pipeline project itself. But even this much is a huge mea culpa on the part of ACE, as they admit that Energy Transfer Partners had no business even starting the project until I's were dotted and T's were crossed. According to that video, thousands are still at the three camps, Ocheti Shekoan, Rosebud, and Sacred Stone. Those who remain are working on consolidating and winterizing the camps and preparing for new action in the spring when the tribal lands will face the threat of privatization. The YouTube reporter had tears as she spoke of this and of the anti-fracking efforts in which she's been involved for the past 8 years of the Obama administration. She said she can only hope that wholesale privatization under Trump would stimulate a full-scale revolution. And she agreed with my assessment that a killery presidency would accomplish the same ends, but in a sneakier way. Quote, like death by a thousand cuts. Unquote. I also learned that the $50,000 a day fine is vastly understated. It's actually at least 10 times that much. Furthermore, if they drill without a permit, the Michaels Corporation would be shut down nationwide and the Dakota Access Permit never granted. Yes, Energy Transfer Partners assured its investors that the pipeline would go through, but what would you expect them to say? Oops, our bad, here's your money back. Not. It makes me quite ill to compare this treatment to the way Occupy activists were treated 5 years ago. It seems to me that under the rule of law, the drilling equipment should be confiscated as evidence of trespassing, and the authorities assessed with fines for vandalism, obstruction of traffic, and reckless endangerment for blockading that bridge. But that's not going to happen with the state representing corporate interests. The Tribal Council's lawsuit in federal court entitles them to seek an injunction pending outcome of the partial environmental impact statement. Negotiations between Energy Transfer Partners and its subcontractors will recommence on 2 January. Yes, the Tribal Council allowed the prayer fire at Sacred Stone to go out on 11 December, but that was part of the ceremony leading up to the solstice, and the fire has now been relit, and the Ocheti Chacoan camp has changed its name to Ocheti Oyate, from the fire of the 7 tribes to the fire of all my relations, in preparation for the return of the water protectors in the spring. Yes, they sent everyone home with generous expressions of gratitude and requests for distributed actions against the financial backing of the project. You can find suggestions for such distributed actions at Sequitur Domain. In short, get serious about divestment and become a locavore. Yet the drilling equipment is still staged with the highway still blocked and the militarized police still exercising close surveillance on the community, despite the vastly reduced population of water protectors.
Attention passengers.
Nobody collects a paycheck from spending the holidays with their family.
The destination of this train is Braintree.
We interrupt this podcast to bring you breaking news just in from my local Standing Rock support group on Facebook. I repeat, this item has not been vetted by corporate media or by the usual alternative sources. There has been a report from boots on the ground that the barricade on the bridge is being cleared. In related news, Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin have pulled their significant money out of the banks that are backing the Dakota Access Pipeline. And last week, legislation was introduced in the Seattle City Council to pull their $3 billion in city finances, including their payroll, out of Wells Fargo. The measure is expected to pass easily next month, and other municipalities such as Minneapolis are considering parallel action. I wondered why we're picking on Wells Fargo when my information is that there are more than 24 banks backing the pipeline. Yes Magazine explains, quote, Wells Fargo is one of 38 banks offering financial support to the pipeline and its parent companies, according to research by Food and Water Watch. But it's one of only 17 banks that have directly financed the pipeline construction by Dakota Access LLC, and it's one of only 7 banks financing all of them with significant lines of credit offered to parent companies Energy Transfer Partners, Energy Transfer Equity, and Sunoco Logistics. The other reason we're picking on Wells Fargo is that they are a relatively easy target due to some other recent scandals and socially irresponsible lending practices. Again from Yes Magazine, quote, the Seattle City Council bill cites how the company, quote, directed employees to fraudulently create more than 2 million unauthorized bank and credit accounts during the past 5 years, negatively affecting the credit ratings of millions of customers, end embedded quote, and terminated 5,300, quote, of the corporation's lowest paid workers, end embedded quote, without firing a single senior executive. As a result of that scandal, Seattle City Light in October ended its $100 million bond financing relationship with the bank, end quote. But make no mistake, there are other pipeline projects financed by other banks that pose just as much of an environmental threat, and they won't stop until they are defunded. Just because there are no human remains to disturb or human homes and businesses to disrupt does not mean the land is fair game for abuse by an extractive industry to prop up an obsolete infrastructure. So don't you stop with photo ops carrying signs at 350.org events. Move your money. Not just your bank account, but your retirement funds and the money you spend at businesses that support these banks. Remember Arundhati Roy's 3-part strategy. Boycott, divest, walk out. We're only talking about the second step here so far. The Standing Rock Sioux are not alone in their resistance on behalf of Pachamama to domination by globalized industrial civilization. So let's wrap up with Standing Rock with a song by Trevor Hall that's more in the reggae tradition, since we're traveling south of the border next.
To get their dollar, treaties being broken, no respect or honor. Listen close, my friend, this is happening. Warrior. Drink the water. Seven generations are the sons and daughters. Gather all your friends. This is happening. Warrior.
That was Standing Rock by Trevor Hall. You can download that one too at bandcamp.com, also on a gift economy basis. I spoke of the Pachamama Alliance in the Sequitur Domain show on 11 November when I had recently been a virtual host of their 20th anniversary gathering. On 7 December, I attended a global teleconference with founder Lynn Twist and I got an update on their inspiring work. Then, just days ago, I stepped through the looking glass and encountered a piece of news that has thrown me into a tailspin. But let me slow down and start at the beginning. In the 1980s, shamans of the Achuar, a tribe living in a part of the pristine Amazon rainforest that had never been in touch with Western civilization, started receiving the warning that the white man would try to invade their lands, cut down the forest, and exploit their resources. The Achuar are among the last remaining dream cultures among us. They were living without telecommunications, electricity, combustion engines, indoor plumbing, and banks, hospitals, and many other institutions we take for granted, so it took them a while to identify the nature of the threat. But they soon started seeing traces from the oil spills and waste stream of the resource extraction industries. In the 1990s, contact was made between John Perkins and Lynn and Bill Twist and the Achuar people. The Westerners found a deeply interconnected tribal society living outside of clock and calendar time and in profound symbiosis and synchrony with the earth. When they learned of the growing concern of the people about the threat to their habitat and culture, they asked how they could help. The answer they received was surprising and straightforward. The elders said, quote, "If you are coming to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you are coming because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together." End quote. And thus was born the Pachamama Alliance. I do so love to tell that origin story. According to Lynn Twist, in 2008, Ecuador became the first country in the world to give primary constitutional rights to nature. Quote, "reminding us that this oppression or repression or ownership or domination of our mother is inappropriate and off course and not who we are, and is the source of so much of the inappropriate hierarchy that is part of our species' misguided, flawed way of seeing the world that has taken us so far afield from who we are as a member of the community of life." End quote. She calls this the Sophia century, the century when women will take their rightful role as co-equal partners with men, when the feminine will take its rightful role as co-equal partner with the masculine, when the yin will take its rightful role as co-equal partner with the yang, when the heart will take its rightful role as co-equal partner with the mind. Twist reports on recent science that finds that not only is the Amazon the lungs of the planet in producing every second breath we take, but is also her vascular system, accounting for more fresh water production than the next greatest seven river systems combined. The scientists now speak of flying rivers as the water is transported on the trade winds as vapor around the world and makes earthfall as rain. The sacred headwaters of southern Ecuador and northern Peru is the region responsible for driving the whole system. This is an area the same size as the USA, the same size as the face of the full moon. I spoke on Sequitur Gratitude of the current matching funds campaign through the end of the year that is earmarked to remove the sacred headwaters out of the realm of property and into the realm of a living forest being with its own permanent protected status. Go to pachamama.org/headwaters and make a donation to this campaign led by 12 indigenous tribes, the children of the jaguar, the original water protectors. Pachamama got my entire holiday gift budget for this season. Also on the Pachamama Global Community Conference call on 7 December was Penny Opal Plant, co-founder of Idle No More Bay Area, who was recently returned from the Maori of New Zealand. She reported that several indigenous tribes formed an alliance and, quote, "were able to extricate the Whanganui River from the mountains to the sea, out of the realm of private property and into having legal standing in the courts, similar to a human person, but with the additional sacred rights of that river," close quote. And as of January, the Tiriwera National Park will have legal standing, quote, "just like the Whanganui River. It's the first time in the history of human beings that these natural living entities will not be considered private property anymore," close quote. There will be a Maori representative and a Crown representative who will be the voices for, quote, "all the beings that live in, under, and above those two entities," close quote. Meanwhile, there was a surprise change at the head of the federal government in New Zealand that included the ascension of Paula Bennett, purportedly an indigenous Maori woman, to the position of Deputy Prime Minister. I asked my friend Kevin Hester for his comments on the implications of this appointment relative to land rights of the Maori people, and he gave me his permission to quote our conversation. He said,
"She is a monster. She climbed the social welfare ladder, then pulled it up behind her. We call her Pull Ya Benefit."
I asked further if he thought she would betray her Maori roots and allow exploitation of native land for corporate profit, and he responded,
"She is a renowned arsehole who is in the right-wing racist government and much hated in New Zealand by everyone, including the Maori. She is considered a traitor."
And for the third time, I probed, "So it sounds like your prognosis for Maori tribal land is grim." Kevin responded,
"They have had 95% of it stolen from them. The rest will be raped."
So there you have it, folks. The opinion of one New Zealander, a mariner who follows the climate crisis quite closely and is therefore in pretty intimate connection with the politics of his bioregion, using that R word I was criticized for using when I was an activist with the resistance to mountaintop removal coal mining 10 years ago in southwestern Virginia. All I can say is please, please say it isn't so. I realize we're not going to save the world, whatever that means, but I would hope, that four-letter word, to see more evidence of that love of life that is all that remains at the edge of extinction, according to Guy McPherson. And when I look at these last pristine places, Standing Rock, the Amazon, New Zealand, all I'm seeing is love of money. So, returning to the Pachamama Global Community Call, Penny Opal Plant issued a clarion call to decolonize our culture from the thrall of money. She said, quote, "We are at a point in history where we are beginning to recognize that many of the problems that we are experiencing with the water, air, and soil are the result of the concept of private property and capitalism. Those two concepts go hand in hand, and they are new. Human beings have been around for well over 100,000 years, and these concepts are only a couple of hundred years old." Close quote. Reflecting on Lynn Twist's proclamation about the Sophia Century, Penny Opal Plant said that women have always had to be strong. Quote, "We know that we're strong because we're alive." Close quote. She described Idle No More as women-led, not women-dominated. Quote, "We can be who we are as women. We move from the heart. We remain within the prayer." End quote. Which takes enormous patience and courage when faced with violence. Reflecting on Standing Rock, Plant called for an end to the damage in our communities to water, food, and air, and to bring about that end with love and prayer. She pointed out that today's youth is the seventh generation of the prophecies, and the stand at Standing Rock was initiated by the youth, who set out on foot to speak with the elders of other tribes, and then went on foot to carry their message to Washington, D.C. Plant said that we and they have a responsibility to act, that we and they were born at this time for a reason. She asked that we offer our gifts to a vibrantly healthy future, not just a viable one. She said that private property, capitalism, and competition are not natural and have outlived their usefulness. She admonished us to have no enemies, because enmity is the way of thinking that gave rise to those outmoded ways of being. In response to a participant's question about how to respond to the obvious sadism of some of the armed authorities, she said we must hold with compassion those who are wounded, that healthy people take no joy in damaging another being. And then Lynn Twist added, "Hurt people, hurt people. Healed people, heal people." Now, fasten your virtual safety harness for that trip to an alternate reality I referenced earlier. The news item that so stunned me was in the Intercontinental Cry, a publication of the Center for World Indigenous Studies. In an article dated on the solstice, I learned that, constitutional rights of nature notwithstanding, the federal government of Ecuador has deployed their military against the Shuar people, one of the original five tribes of the Pachamama Alliance. Say what? I wrote to the Pachamama Alliance and to founder John Perkins specifically, to Starhawk, and to Cindy Sheehan, three high-profile activists in the field of the rights of indigenous people to stewardship of their ancestral lands, but it's too soon to expect a response. I'll give an update if and when I hear anything. Meanwhile, I continue to do research. Article 73 of that exemplary Constitution of Ecuador says, quote, "The state shall apply preventive and restrictive measures on activities that might lead to the extinction of species, the destruction of ecosystems, and the permanent alteration of natural cycles," end quote. Note that there is no stipulation that sites must be inhabited by humans, alive or dead, indigenous or otherwise. According to an article in The Guardian dated 6 December 2014, quote, "Ecuador has seen its environmental reputation nosedive in recent years as President Rafael Correa has put more emphasis on exploitation of oil, gas, and minerals, partly to pay off debts to China. Luis Corral, an advisor to Ecuador's Assembly of the People of the South, reported to The Guardian that if José Isidro Tendenza Antun, a former vice president of the Shuar Federation of Zamora, had been able to travel to the Cop-Out 20 in Lima instead of being tortured and killed a few days before his planned departure, it would have put in, quote, grave doubt the honorability and the image of the Ecuadorian government as a guarantor of the rights of nature. We believe that this murder is part of a pattern of escalating violence against indigenous leaders, which responds to the Ecuadorian government and the company's need to clear the opposition to a mega mining project in the Cordillera del Condor. The state police and judiciary is involved in hiding this violent crime because of the elemental irregularities in the proceedings. The body was buried without informing the family. They weren't allowed to see the second autopsy," end quote. Tendesta's killing highlights the risks facing environmental activists in Ecuador. Meanwhile, a group of campaigners traveling in a climate caravan was stopped 6 times by police on the way to Lima, and eventually their bus was confiscated. The activists said they were held back because President Correa wants to avoid potentially embarrassing protests at the climate conference over his plan to drill for oil in Yasuni, an Amazon reserve and one of the most biodiverse places on Earth. I would hope that the circumstances surrounding Tendetza's killing will be sorted out before the Cop-Out 23. But actually, after this week's assassination of the Russian ambassador to Turkey, we might just have to accept the reality that diplomacy is a high-risk occupation everywhere in a world gone mad. Thank you for listening to Sequitur, archived at panina.org, and special thanks to John Compost Cossum for his research and reflections on generosity, to Jiwa Woodbury, Charles Eisenstein, and Starhawk for the clarity of their insight into the spiritual dimension of activism, to Cosmos, Counterpunch, The Guardian, and Yes Magazine for better-than-decent journalism, to Kevin Hester for his continuing support as I seek to expand my global consciousness, to Lynn Twist, Penny Opal Plant, and the rest of the Pachamama Alliance, especially their indigenous partners, for their work in protecting the sacred headwaters of the Amazon, to the First Nations people of roughly 200 nations who showed up in solidarity at Standing Rock, and the thousands of awakened dreamers of the Western world who stood by their side, to Pray with Standing Rock for the song The Whole World is Watching, to Trevor Hall for the song Standing Rock, to Dorset Campbell Ross for his performance of Ruth Bebermeyer's Given To, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
see it and now you don't. Going through walls and floors, through the ages and out of time. It's only matter, it's no matter at all. It created this in its travels, coming through. What connects us is one.